Hi, and welcome to the RUP podcast. I'm James Roycroft Davis, and I founded this podcast after I recently found myself in a rut, feeling like I was never going to come out. But I did, because I started talking about how I felt. This podcast features mostly men's stories about getting into a rut, what it was like being there, but most importantly, how they got out of it.
In this episode of The Rut, I welcome Will Fraser to the podcast. Will is a former professional rugby player with Saracens, sadly having to retire from the game prematurely through injury a few years ago at the age of 27. Will has won 3 Premiership titles, 2 European Cups, and a host of other domestic accolades, and was a member of the famous Saracens Class of 08, with the likes of Owen Farrell, Jamie George, George Cruz, and Jackson Bray. However, Will faced one of his biggest challenges yet in 2009, when his brother Henry broke his neck on holiday, and it changed Will's outlook on life forever. There's a lot discussed in this episode, including that class of 08 and what made them so good. We explore the series of events in 2009 around Henry's injury and the effect it had on Will's mental health and mindset. We also discuss the impact the endless list of injuries had, which ultimately forced Will to retire from the game he loved, and how his brother's horrific injury completely changed Will's attitude towards injuries, setbacks, mental health, and resilience. So, here's Will's story, so please leave all judgment at the door.
Will, welcome to The Rut. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
No problem. Let's dive straight in. Why did you want to come on the podcast in the first place?
Well, I suppose at the moment with everything that's going on in the world, mental health is obviously a really kind of important thing to be thinking about. And then for me personally, with I suppose my own rugby career and how that went and other various bits and bobs, I've been very fortunate to not necessarily struggle with myself, but I can fully appreciate how it can affect people. And I suppose I've been on my own journey with it in terms of actually having a much deeper appreciation for the impact it can have on people and kind of realizing that actually there's a lot more that needs to be done around obviously creating awareness around it, but then obviously doing something with that awareness. So obviously you doing this is kind of honing in on all those bits, so it seemed like a fairly obvious one to be a part of.
We hope, and thank you for being a part of it. Let's go into your story, because it's an unbelievable one, and you're only 30.
All the wrong reason is unbelievable.
Yeah. Talk to me, take me back to really, obviously growing up as a teenager, being part of the Saracen Academy, and as I think somebody's put it in the press, the kind of Saracens class of 92, as it were.
Yeah, I was a Robbie Savage of that one. That kind of I suppose as a teenager, I had an amazing upbringing. Couldn't ask for anything more than what we were given. And I joined the junior academy at 14. So kind of back when. We were kids. The way it worked was each club had a catchment area of counties that they could kind of cherry pick kids from. And for the Saracens, it was Hertfordshire, Essex and Kent. And I played for Hertfordshire County, so under 14s. 10 of us from the county got picked to go in the junior setup at the club. And fortunately, kind of through all my school years, managed to stay on within the junior academy setup. Tuesday, Thursday night training sessions, and then at 18, Eddie Jones was director of rugby at the club at the time. And at 18, straight out of school, was fortunate enough to be given my first professional academy contract. So I joined the senior academy at 18, and then kind of dived into professional rugby, if you like. So there was nothing really special about my journey through, or nothing really kind of extraordinary about it. It was just that's how it happened back then, and I was very fortunate.
With the class of 92, as it were, did you realise that during that period when you were playing with the likes of Jamie George, Owen Farrell,
George Cruz, etc., in that class of 92. Did you realise this was an exceptional group?
Yes. Did I realise how well those boys would do? A couple of them, yes. A couple of them, definitely not. So I think what was nice about our journey through was that, you know, Jamie played a year up, so we both started the junior setup at the same time. Jacko joined when he was 16. Faz joined when he was about 13 or 14, but a couple of years after me because he's a couple of years younger. Georgian joined until he was 18, so we went full time. But I think what was great was that we were just good friends from kind of day one. We were such a tight group, and there was other guys as well around that group as well that unfortunately either didn't get offered a contract at 18 or did and subsequently left to join other clubs or whatever it is. But as a group of people, we were just so tight, and I think that was what was great about it. And then, you know, you had your Owens and Jamies that played every England age group through the systems, 16s, 18s, 20s. So you obviously knew where they were going. You had people like myself who didn't really get a sniff. I did England 16s, but didn't really get a sniff at other bits. So I was kind of, I don't know, I suppose I was always trying to keep up with them in many ways, which was brilliant for me because you had those kind of rabbits ahead of you. You know, I was just trying to kind of catch up and chase them. But they were brilliant at actually bringing me along as well. And all of us, you know, there was no, considering you were fighting for kind of contracts, there was no selfishness. There was no, we almost considered ourselves a little team within the bigger team. And it was trying to kind of bring as many of us along that journey as we possibly could. And then you had George, who joined at 18. And, you know, it's well documented that he wasn't the best player in the world when he joined Saracen. What he did have was he was tough when he first joined. Like, I remember the first AD game he played in. At six, and he just got battered by a brick wall all night, but he kept running in it. He just kept going. So you knew he had something, and then he's kind of blossomed into one of the best second rows in the world, which has been phenomenal. So yeah, I mean, it was looking back, I mean, I would give everything to still be there and still be a part of it. But looking back, I feel incredibly fortunate that I was able to be a part of a very special group of people, and a group that I think you probably won't find another one for a long, long time. No. As successful as they've been. No.
I think we'll try and call it the Saracens 08 group, because I think it was Nigel Ray who coined it, or likened it to the class of 92, and quite rightly so. You were not going to find another group of players like that in rugby for a long, long time. What type of characteristics, I suppose, were instilled within that group of people? Why do you think everybody was so successful in that Saracen team as you grew up?
I think a big reason is the one I've already said, in terms of we all just got on phenomenally well, and we had this vision of ourselves as I say, this kind of team within the team. So when we were coming through the club, it was complete opposite to what it is now, in the sense that as an academy group, you were only part of the club by badge alone. There was no integration with the senior boys. There was, you know, we used to have to be moved to go train at local schools or local rugby clubs in case our schedules clashed with the first team. So it was literally like keep them away. And so that in itself kind of festered this feeling, okay, we're our own little unit. So we have to do what we can to stick together and get as many people to make that jump. You then mix that in with individual personalities, and you have some incredibly driven people in that group. I liked it myself as one of them. Actually, everyone was incredibly driven, to be fair, because we all wanted to succeed. We wanted to do it together. And then we had coaches at the time. I remember when the club kind of went through this revolution in 2009, and as an academy group, all of a sudden, we went from never seeing the first team players to training with them every single day. There was this kind of real need that our academy coach is telling us that we need to be the ones to drive those sessions. You know, we should be the ones, don't be afraid to really push forward in those sessions and kind of stand up and be counted. And I think that's probably, in my mind anyway, I always remember being told that as a group and really trying to do what we could to live up to it. But, you know, as I say, for me personally, having the lads I had to kind of grow up with be best friends with and inspire me. You know, I was the last one to make my debut for the club because of injuries and bits and bobs like that. And by that point, you know, I think Faz had probably played for England by this point. Jeremy had 50 club caps under his belt. George had played. Jackson was playing. And it was just that, you know, you want to be a part of it, I think is the biggest thing. And you wanted to do it with people you genuinely cared for and loved. So I think, yeah, all those things kind of meshed together, I think, created this incredible, you know, the fact that four of them now are still there and three of them.
Yes, somebody.
Jackson should be kind of a 30, 40, 50 cap international, but that's probably a whole another podcast on its own to talk about that one.
Just some Jackson, right?
But it's I think it's just I do count myself now that I can look, unfortunately, look back at it retrospectively. I do count myself to be part of an incredibly amazing group of people, and I feel very, very privileged for it.
2009 was a monumental year in your life, really, wasn't it? For a number of reasons. Obviously, Brendan Venter came in to Saracens, and I think there was something called Black Monday, the entire team almost shifted into
14 players got sacked in a day.
And you were one of the lucky ones to be given a contract. Mm-hmm. And then your brother Henry, he had a horrific neck injury on holiday. Was it in Portugal?
It was, in Lagos, Niagos.
I think Henry's injury is well known because he's obviously spoken about it so much and publicised it as well as he's done for multiple reasons. But talk me through Henry's injury from your perspective. I'm very interested to understand the series of events that happened around that and how that affected you and your mental health. So obviously Henry's had his injury and presumably you got a phone call.
So myself, just going back a little bit before. So when Eddie left and Brendan took over, myself and Jacko, Jackson Ray, were in South Africa at the time because Eddie had sent us out to play for Western Province Academy. And so we got called back early. So we came back, Jack came back a couple weeks after me because I needed surgery. But I came back kind of mid-June. Into this kind of new Saracens and with Brendan there and a whole hatful new players, this, that and the other. And then the 18th of July, so literally about a month after, we'd only been back in pre-season for a couple of weeks. I'd had surgery in the off-season after coming back to South Africa, so I was on sticks at the time. And it was over a weekend. I was actually down in Bournemouth with my older brother. He was at uni down there. And so I'd gone down to spend the weekend with him. And we were getting ready for a night out. You know, we were kind of all dolled up, had a few drinks. And we got a call from mum or dad, but basically saying, because Henry was on holiday at the time, was basically saying, he's banged his head. We don't think it's anything too serious. But we just wanted to let you know that we think he's maybe knocked himself out. He's gone to hospital, but it's nothing serious. So we go, okay, fine, no dramas. And as the evening went on, we had two or three more calls, and kind of each one was a little bit worse. It was, okay, he's in the hospital. His friends have been able to go with him. We think it might be a little bit more than a head knock, but he'll be all right. Then dad's going to fly out because they're not too sure what's really going on. Then it was, okay, we're both going to fly out because it sounds quite serious. So it kind of got to the point where me and Tom, it sounds ridiculous now, but the debate in our head was, do we still go out or not? You know, so we've had a few drinks already. We're in his house with his uni mates. Kind of, do we stay in? Because obviously if it's pretty bad, and we had no idea any detail. All we knew was that he banged his head. That was it. We kind of said, we concluded, because he was a fit, strong guy, and you know, we thought he's probably just whacked his head doing something stupid, and he's probably got a really bad concussion, but he's a tough lad, but he'll be fine. So we went out and actually had quite a good night. And then the next day, sort of on a hangover as well, which didn't help, but kind of throughout the day we're getting various updates from mum and dad, and kind of each one the situation was slowly getting worse and worse and worse. And you know, he basically spent 3 weeks in intensive care in Portugal. So when mum and dad flew out, you know, they didn't come back until Henry came back. So it was me, Tom, my older brother, and my youngest brother, Dom, was on holiday at the time with his mates. So we didn't want to tell him when he was away because we wanted him to enjoy his holiday and we'll kind of unload on him when he gets back. So we had this kind of big mission to keep it quiet. And it's, I still don't know how it somehow got leaked out to friends and family. But
at what point did you know it was very serious?
Fairly soon after. I mean, the day, to be honest, I think it was probably the day after when mum and dad flew out and rang us when they saw it, because and obviously he's written his book about it, and it's as you say, been well publicised. But you know, when mum and dad were out there, I think he technically died about 7 times because heart rate dropped so low.
Extraordinary.
I think, you know, mum says you saw the colour kind of going, and
wow.
So obviously having that relayed back, and obviously mum and dad not wanting to tell us, we didn't know that until months after, maybe even longer. Those bits they just obviously didn't want to tell us because you know, it's not nice to hear about your little brother. But
what was going through your head at the time?
I don't know, really. Not a lot, but everything at the same time.
Mm.
It's strange because all you're thinking about is, you know, I don't want to use blue language, but you know, you're thinking, what the
mate,
fuck?
crack on with any language you want.
Well, you're just thinking, what the fuck is going on? You know, it's the sort of situation where you hear about things like this and you read about these amazing people that deal with these life-changing accidents and all the rest of it, but you're so disconnected from it because it's someone you've never met across the other side of the world. So when it happens so close to home, you just start thinking about, but for me and Tom remember, because we drove back home that afternoon and we're obviously in the car, and Tom was brilliant. He was proper older brother, you know, like stayed strong with the rest of it, whilst I was sobbing away in the passenger seat. But you just start thinking about all the little things, you know, you start, like a lot of these things, you jump to worst case scenario straight off the bat.
Yes.
So we didn't know actually the detail behind what the specific injury was to his spinal cord. We didn't necessarily know what level it was. He had all these operations that were coming up that were hopefully going to help him. But you just start thinking worst case scenario, thinking, well, will he ever be able to do this again? Or is he ever going to be able to do that? And, you know, how are we going to deal with it? And all this kind of stuff. But it's because you can't see him either. So we didn't see him for three and a half weeks after, because he, as I say, he was in Portugal. So he had to get airlifted from Lisbon. So he basically did it in the Algarve, and he got airlifted from the Algarve to Lisbon. So none of his mates even saw him till 2 months after the accident. So, you know, his poor mates saw him face down, bobbing in the sea, and they didn't see him again. So, you know, in a way, gone. They didn't know what was, you know, it was pretty horrific for them. I suppose it wasn't till, I mean, nothing really sunk in until we saw him for the first time, because you're just getting it all over the phone. And that was bad. That was tough. But then you go see him, and then it's just a whole, like.
And where did you see him? Did you fly out, or he came back?
No, he came back. Yeah, so he always had to come back. Obviously, you can't stay out there the whole time. So he got flown back to Stoke Mandeville in Buckinghamshire. So it's a world-renowned spinal cord specialist spinal cord injury hospital. So he got flown back there with mum and dad, obviously. And then mum came and picked us up from home. And it was me, Tom and Dom. And on the drive there, it was a good kind of, I don't know, 45 minute drive from where we were living at the time. And I just remember mum in the car kind of trying to tee us up for, you know, prep us for what we were going to see. And there's nothing you can really, you know, there's nothing you can really say that fully prepares.
No.
But just essentially saying, look, he looks very different. He's got a lot of, he's on a life support. He's got a lot of tubes kind of in and out of his body.
How did that feel?
It was just sad. It's desperately, desperately sad. Because there's nothing you can do. You know, it's like a lot of these situations, there's nothing you can do. You just got to. So we went in and, you know, what, a nurse came out before we went in and again tried to prep us for it.
Trying to soften the blow.
I just think, you know, because you can't really comprehend the difference between when we last saw him to when we saw him.
I can imagine.
So we turned, he was, I mean, it's awful, but equally it was actually a godsend, because he with everything else that's going on, he'd contracted MRSA and I think pneumonia at the time because his immune system was that low. So when he was in intensive care back home in St. Mandeville, he got his own room because obviously they want to risk things spreading. So although it made him feel worse because he was obviously ill on top of it all, it was brilliant because, you know, we had a room with him to ourselves. And, you know, intensive care is not, you know, the stuff other people go through on that ward, and you're just, it was weird, man, because you just hear like people in pain.
Yeah,
it's just, it's not, but anyway, so yeah, so we turned the corner, went in the room, and you're just seeing Henry's kind of, he's just lying on this bed, he's lost like a ton of weight because he's not moved for the best part of a month. As I say, he's on life support, he's got tubes in everywhere. It was, I always, to this day, I always say it was hands down the worst day of my life, bar none, like, to see that. But the other side, it was hands down the best day of my life,
because that's so interesting.
There was every chance that he could not have been there. Just absolutely. To see him, just to see him was just amazing, considering there was a high chance he might not have seen him. But then, you see him in the way that the state he's in, and you're like, "Shit, that's not fun." So I just remember, and he couldn't talk at the time because when you're on life support, it takes your voice away. So he just has to like mouth like that. So you're trying to talk to him, and bless him, he's trying to talk back, and you're having to lip read him and all this stuff, and then you're hugging him. And it was weird because you're hugging him, but you know he can't feel you're hugging him.
Yeah,
that was weird. That took me a long time. But you know, I got to a point where, for the first couple of weeks, I'd sit in his bed and just squeeze his leg, just kind of hoping that he like jumps or you know he feels something. And then when you realise that's not going to happen, I really struggled to touch him where he couldn't feel it for a long time, just because it's just too weird for me. But then once you deal with that, as with everything. Yeah, well, I say once he dealt with that, which then in turn meant that we dealt with it. You know, you crack on with it, and actually,
yeah. How did you deal with it? Because it must have had an impact on your mental health. I'm not saying you were in an awful place because of it, but that's a lot to deal with.
It is, like, you know, it's amazing when you go through stuff, and then because when you don't think about a lot of things when you're in it. When stuff's going on, whatever it is, you don't take a step back and appreciate what's happening at the time. It's only down the line or years down the line you can look back retrospectively and actually properly analyse what you were thinking and feeling. And so I think when I look back at it now, again, I just count myself extremely lucky that my family are my family. You know, we were very tight beforehand, but obviously this brought us even closer. So that's the first way we dealt with it. Is just, I have the most amazing, everyone has the most amazing family, but I have the most amazing family in terms of the way they dealt with it. And then on top of that, to be part of the club at that time was an absolute blessing in disguise, because it just meant, you know, I remember calling my academy coach and trying to explain to him what had happened. Like, it was a Monday morning, he took me aside, out the team meeting, it got announced to the other academy boys first, because you've got to remember as well, you know, Faz, Jamie, Jacko, these boys all played with H, because H was in the academy for a while as well.
Yeah.
They knew him very personally, so, you know, they had to deal with it as well. So they got told, then the senior lads got told, and Brendan and the club were unbelievable. They just said, whatever you need to do, do it. If you don't want to come in, don't come in. You know, if you need to take a week off, take a week off. If you want us to do anything, just let us know. But I actually went the other way. And I tried to be, not tried to be in as much as possible, but I looked forward to going in, because it was kind of, it was just, it took you away from what was happening. And actually, I had other stuff to be focusing on. You know, I was injured myself at the time. I'd had ankle surgery, so I was going through my own rehab kind of process. So that kind of focus and clarity in what I needed to do helped me really kind of separate the two issues. And then the club were unbelievable. I mean, they've raised huge amounts of money for him. He opened Allianz Park. You know, he's got his name on as many walls and plaques at the stadium as I do, which is great, but equally slightly considering I played there for 10 years. But it's, I mean, that I just think we had an incredible network of people from all walks of life around us that without, you know, you don't know how you would have dealt with it, really.
You played 83 times for Saracens, I think. You won the Premiership 3 times, Europe twice.
I was part of the teams that won it.
Well, you did. You won Europe twice.
Yeah.
I was there both times.
Yeah.
You're capped by England section 3 times as well. By anybody's standards, you've had an unbelievably successful rugby career, even by the time you'd retired at the age of 27. Mm-hmm. What are your best memories?
My best memory from a rugby point of view, the first European Cup was like
in Lyon.
Out of this world. Like it was fairly well documented. I was kind of a bit like, you know, the Jack Wilshere of rugby. You know, I couldn't piece more than 5 games together without being out for 6 months with some form of surgery or something. So I'd missed the other, you know, the European final that we'd lost and various semis. So to play that, to start that game and to play the full 80, and just, I like, it's still surreal. It's where I often think back to it. It's almost like it never happened in the sense that, because it was so long ago and I'm in such a different life now, it's weird to look back and think that I played in that. In a good way. Like, it was just so surreal. So that, for me, that match, the match itself was brilliant to play in. The night afterwards was like, I mean, we didn't even really leave the hotel. It was just in the hotel.
No.
Like, bar thing. And were you there? You would have been in there.
I was there, yeah.
I mean, that was just, you know, as loose as you could probably get within the confines of a hotel kind of conference room.
Yeah, I mean, getting in on the team coach and going into Lyon and being not being allowed into that club in the centre of Lyon.
Well, mate, I think I'd had too many by that point. I missed that. I missed that extra bit of the night. But it was, mate, and then to have all, you know, my whole family was there.
Yeah.
Henry was there. You know, we had him on the dance floor and spinning him around. So that, for me, from a rugby point of view, that, and then 2 weeks later to then win the Prem as well. For a rugby point of view, yeah, they're obviously right up there, and my debut as well. But in terms of the career, like, there's too many to really pick out. And if you think about, you know, the trips we went on, the people, the friends you make along the way, the tiny little moments at the training ground or in the changing room, or, you know, when you're playing, you head to one of the last house and you're playing FIFA, whatever it is. Like, it's just, it was an absolute dream for me to,
of course,
do what I did. And as I'm extremely, I count myself very privileged and very fortunate to have done it. I would love to have played more, like, even if I still had to retire at 27, I would love to have played 100 games for the club. I would have loved to pretend maybe have gone on one of the England tours or something like that. But with the same token, it's very rare that people get to live out their childhood dreams and do so. So,
let's talk about injuries, because you had a hell of a lot of them in your career. What was it? 10 major surgeries?
10 operations, and God knows how many actual, like,
clear outs. Yeah,
injuries along the way.
Yeah. So you've had shoulders, obviously neck, which was the career-ending injury.
Yeah, so I didn't have surgery on my neck. Neck ended the career, but I had, I'm trying to look at my body now and try and go through it. So I had two on my foot, both ankles, two on my knee, back, two hips, and I'd ripped my lat off the bone, so I had to have that reattached. And then probably about numerous court, you know, injections and durals and various other bits and bobs.
How did you cope with injuries, because you've had an awful lot of them? And actually, one of the key themes in a lot of the stories that I've covered on this podcast is the successive incidents, things that happened in people's lives that basically meant their mental health suffered because of it. They couldn't come up to the surface for air. you've had back-to-back injuries. It seems like you've coped with them mentally relatively well, actually, based on what's happened to you. But why is that? And how has injuries affected your mental health?
Well, I kind of look at it again. There's, I suppose, me and injuries, personally, there's the two kind of phases, if you like. So when I was younger, and actually it's kind of in and around Henry's accident. So kind of pre all that happening, in terms of my rugby, I was a kid. I was on an academy contract. I was trying to push for a senior contract. I was watching my best mates go on to play first in rugby, and I wasn't quite making it because I kept kind of getting hit back with various niggles and injuries and stuff. And I didn't deal with it very well. Just purely in the sense that I'd just get really pissed off, upset, frustrated, and it would just fester. And it wasn't a very healthy way of kind of dealing with a setback. So I wasn't very, you know, I just get super emotional about it. And then Henry's thing happened. And it was this is a complete subconscious shift in my mindset. Like, at no point, I had more injuries and surgeries after Henry's accident than before. But hand on heart, every time I had one, I never, ever thought, oh, well, Henry's dealt with what he's dealt with, therefore I need to just crack on and deal with this. No, it never, ever entered my mind.
Really?
It was never. And I'm not saying that bad, but it was more of this subconscious thing of actually going, like, okay, like, I just need to crack on with this.
The trauma you've seen is...
Yeah, and it was all, the subconscious change is massive. I just think I went from this place of getting pissed off and feeling down off myself and this, that and the other, where actually then you kind of go, well, if I do that, the one thing I'm stopping is the very thing I want to do, which is get back to playing rugby. So the longer it festers and I hold on to it, the longer my recovery is going to be, the longer it is until I'm going to get on the pitch again. So, you know, you stop by holding on to it in your head, you stop yourself doing the exact thing you want to be doing. So that was and that was all purely through watching and learning and seeing how incredibly well H dealt with all his stuff. But then you mix that in with this whole thing of actually learning about yourself. So you learn a lot about yourself when things are going well, but you learn a hell of a lot more about yourself when things are going wrong.
What did you learn?
Well, I learned how to deal with things. I figured out there was a process for me to go through in order to get to that point where you go, right, okay, I need to deal with this now. So
the process being pissed off.
The process was that I needed to vent. Like, I needed to get out of the system in order to then be okay and deal with it. So my whole thing, I got it down to a T, where, you know, you go see the consultant and you knew you're probably going to be out for a while, and they say, you know, you've got surgery out for 6 months or whatever it is. And it got to a point towards the end where me and my physio, no one says name to jeopardise him, but there was a pub next door to where the consultant worked. So we always go in there for a consultancy pint. We get the news and we get back for one more pint to talk about it, and we go. So I deal with that. So you just hold on to it. I get home and I'd just go in my room, lock the door, punch a few pillows, scream, have a shout, just get everything out, like 15 minutes, just being a bit of a weirdo and a bit of a maniac. And then it was out of my system. Okay, right, sweet. What do I need to do? And then you just get on with it. And that was just how I only learned that through, you mix the experience of what Henry went through, mixed in with me, as you say, having kind of numerous consecutive setbacks and getting to a point where, okay, like, you know, I need to be dealing with this. But then also, and again, this is to do with Henry's accident, actually having a much greater appreciation for the situation, the position that I was in, and how fortunate I was. You know, it got to a point by the end where you get injured, you just go, I'm still being paid to keep fit. I'm still being paid to have a brilliant time and have good crack with people that I genuinely love and care about. I'm still being paid to be part of one of the most incredible organisations out there. What do I really actually have to be sad about? And the answer is nothing. And I think that, and again, that was a really subconscious change. Looking back, I think off the back of what everything that happened. I think we on our kind of prequel to this, I think I mentioned like I'm a big believer that you're a product of your experiences and your environment.
Yeah,
I think it's this whole thing that when stuff goes wrong, knowing that it's gone wrong, but actually having this kind of outlook of going, well, what can I learn from it? I think it's huge because if stuff goes wrong, you don't learn anything from it, then it's a pointless, you might as well not try in the first place. But I think I got this thing like, what can I learn from it? What can I do to make sure that I reduce the risk of this happening again and I'm actually better for it? And I think, weirdly, you know, for everything that's gone on, and H says the same about his accident, I think I'm a much better person of having gone through what I've been through. And the reality is I haven't even been through that much. You know, this is the crux of it. Like, the reality is, for a professional rugby player, you could argue, I went through a lot. But there's a hell of a lot of people in life that have gone through fucking shitload more than that. I mean, look at everything that's going on at the moment, you know.
Yeah.
That, and what I've been through pales insignificant to things like that, you know. So I think it just gives perspective. That's probably the word I should have used.
Yes.
It's just everything that's happened just gives you a better perspective on life and actually what's important and what's not.
Did you have any concerns with your family watching, especially I think your mum and dad obviously were, when you were playing, were watching you week in, week out, as well as some of your brothers at times. But did you have any concerns with your injuries, with your family watching, especially in light of your brother's injury?
No, I selfishly had none, but they had loads. my dad's still now. Yeah, he's like, I would love for you to still be playing, but equally, thank God you're not.
Really?
He just says it's so, you know, it's so physical now. Yeah, and I think Henry's thing, had a big impact on them from that point of view. You know, every time they see, but even before Henry's accident, every time they'd see me on the floor as a parent, obviously, you know, it's not very nice to see your kid hurt. But then with Henry's accident, it's saying, you know, you then realise what could happen. Because it has, you know, that happened. So I think from there, it was always kind of quite stressful, I think, and quite tense for them, particularly if they saw me hurt or whatever it was. But they're like, you know, to for them to deal with my three brothers, including Henry and my mum and dad, to deal with what happened to H, and then to still support me and back me and follow me all over Europe for games and sacrifice what they did for me is remarkable.
You know? Extraordinary, yeah.
It really is. And again, I'll probably say it too many times, but I am extremely fortunate from that point of view.
Yeah. You had to retire from a neck injury. When was it, 2018 or 17?
17.
But actually before...
2018 season, but it was...
Right, yeah. And before that, you'd had, what was it, a double operation on your hip?
Yeah, two hip ops.
Which you'll need replacing anyway, presumably.
At some point, yeah.
Yeah.
And then before that, I had quite a big back up and,
You had to retire from the neck injury. How did that neck injury come about? Was it a specific incident or was it just overuse, as it were?
Yeah, no, it was just a one-off thing in training, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so just in training, and we're doing a scrummaging session. It was a down, so I was just coming back from my hip ops. It was kind of building into my second game back, and it was in what is now the Premiership Cup and what was the LV. And in those weeks, the lads have been playing regularly, kind of get a week off. So in terms of training, we always brought another team in to train against. We brought Ealing in to train against, and those boys are bloody enormous. And we were doing a scrummaging session and I was on the flank and I just kind of ducked my head in to help our prop out at the time. And I just cricked my neck. Well, I thought I just cricked my neck. So, you know, you're walking around the rest of the day, a bit like a board and you can't turn to you like this. And you carry on with training and you know, I was in a lot of pain with it, but you know, you just think it's just a really bad cricked neck. Anyway, it didn't get any better. And then a little while later, I was in the gym. And I got onto the bench press, and if you ask any of the boys, they'll tell you, like, I wasn't very strong anyway, so I didn't have a lot of weight on the bar. And as I've kind of pulled it down, I've gone to push it up, and here's my right. I just couldn't get anything out of one arm. So one arm's gone up, the other one's just stayed there. And with all one arm, I was trying to get, and I couldn't fire it up. And so I've gone, that's not right. Something's off there. So we went for another scan, and what it showed is that I slipped a disc in my neck and got a bleed on my spine. So the bleed on the spine was obviously cutting off the neural pathways to my arm, which meant that I couldn't get the muscles firing in order to do anything. So we went through that, and then, you know, it was a long rehab process and a slow...
How did that feel? Obviously, you've just come back from a hip injury.
Yeah, I was pissed off, obviously. I'd only played four games, I think, that season because of it. So I missed the start of the season because of my hips. Played four games, and that happened, and it was... I was royally pissed off, of course, but like with others, it was kind of like, okay, sweet, let's just do what we can. And this, it sounds weird as well, but you get used to being injured. I don't know if that's good or bad. I think it's good in the sense that you can deal with it, but it's bad in the sense
it's part and parcel of rugby, really.
It just becomes normal. So it was just a case of like, let's do what we can, let's figure out a plan and rehab and get some time frames in place and this, that and the other. But unfortunately,
At what stage did you begin to realise, presumably with the physios and the consultants you were seeing, that this wasn't going to have the desired outcome you wanted?
That's five months down the line, and you're kind of getting there and you're not really seeing any change. And rehab is tedious as well, like especially kind of neck ones. It's these tiny little things you got to do, and it just gets a bit boring. Yeah. It's kind of mundane, it's tedious, and I wasn't doing anything. You know, if you're rehabbing and doing these mundane things, but it's having an impact, then you do them all day long. But when you're doing them all day long and it's not having any difference, you start going, okay, well, what's going on here? So we went back for another couple of scans, another couple of consultancies, and essentially it was just a very black and white decision from the consultant. It was, happy mind in the end, but very black and white advice, and basically saying we could operate on you, we could do a replacement, a disc replacement, whatever, the fusion, but one, the reality of you getting back to playing is no greater after doing it than if we don't do it, and two, you want to avoid neck surgery like the plague. So it was very much kind of, you know, the chances of getting back to playing are very, very slim because nothing's really changed on the scan. So, you know, you take that information and do as you will. So it was a very indirect way of basically saying, unfortunately, I think that's it. So that was tough. Like that was, and in reality, I probably knew it was coming for months beforehand because you know in the back of your mind, but you obviously hold on to every slither of hope that you can. So yeah, that was hard. Like my wife kind of.
What did that feel like?
Oh, it was awful. That was worse. That was terrible. Just in the sense that, like, you know, it's just very emotional because you put so much into it, and there's so much more you would have wanted. I wanted to do within the game at the time. Mm. You feel like at the time I felt like I hadn't done anything. To be completely honest, I don't know. I didn't feel like I had any real impact on the club. I didn't feel like I'd achieved anywhere near what I wanted to and thought I could have done. Mm-hmm. And it was always because of injury. And then so for an injury to kind of be the final thing, I suppose, made sense, but equally was more frustrating because it's this kind of thing you can't shake off. So that was tough. My wife, you know, a lot of emotions, a lot of crying, a lot of tears. And then just trying to come to terms with it. And it was, I suppose, the same outlook in the end, you know, the same process of dealing with injuries is how I dealt with this, but just it just took longer where, you know, you just need that, you need to have those sessions of just kind of bawling your eyes out and woe is me and all this kind of stuff to then be able to kind of take that step back and look back at it and go, well, actually, as you say, you know, I played a decent amount of games at the time, what was one of the best clubs in the world. I've got a European medal and Premiership medal up on my wall. I've made friends with people I grew up watching. I played with and against some of the best players in the world. I get to call some of the best players in the world my best friends. You know, in reality, what is there actually to be sad about? And the answer is not a lot. But again, you've got to go through that, I suppose, that process. And again, don't get me wrong, I'd give it all back to still be playing.
Of course.
Also would. But then mixed in with that, the club looked after me phenomenally well throughout my whole career. You know, if I'd been part of another club, I have no doubt I would have been released about 24, 25 because I was probably one of the worst returns on investment in the league. Yeah, you're paying me a salary and you're getting nothing back from it. You know,
but fucking good over the ball, though. That's the most important.
But it was, you know, it was only one from, if you look at it from a business decision, they had no, there was no reason for them to keep holding me. They were just loyal and incredibly good to me. And then finishing, you know, giving me the job with the in the commercial side that they did probably, probably saved my soul more than I ever realised at the time.
On a call before this podcast, you said to me that one of the worst parts is that you still feel like there's unfinished business.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Not unfinished business in the sense that I think I could have done more. I think I should have done more. There's a thing that even if I finished at 27, I still think I could have and should have done more in the game.
Which is amazing, given you won 3 premierships, 2 European Cups, and should have gone on the England tour to Argentina in 2013, bar injury. So you were clearly good enough.
But that is it in a nutshell. Bar an injury, I should have got, like, you know. And listen, this isn't me getting above my station and saying I should have been capped and I should have done this because, you know.
No, of course.
Like, it's just me. I just would have liked to have had the opportunity to give it a better crack.
Sure.
And it was just frustrating because there's always, as you say, an injury that stops the opportunity. And whether or not I would have been capped, who knows, you know, but I think I could have given it a decent shot. But it's also then you just look at again and it's just my close mates, you know, the 08 class 08 boys, and you look at what they've achieved in the game. And I have this immense sense of pride. You know, I watch it now like a, I feel like a proud dad almost, and you watch what they're doing and all the rest of it.
I've got a quote here from Jamie George, actually, which I thought I've included this here because it was so good. I don't know whether you've heard it or seen it before, but it says, "Will's an incredibly resilient person, and you'd watch him on a Monday. You'd see him limp across the field, and I can actually picture it now. And you think there's no way that this guy will be able to play a game on a Saturday. And there he was, he'd get himself right, he'd make sure he's okay, and as okay as he could be, and he'd be there on a Saturday giving everything. That's a sign of the player he was." I mean, how does that make you feel?
Well, it's nice. It's lovely. It's, it's really nice, especially from someone like, you know, as close as we are, me and him are, and with what he's done in the game. I think it's lovely to hear. You don't really think about when you're doing stuff. You're not doing it to impress anyone or to do. In many ways, I'm doing it for them because I don't want to let them down in the game because I'm crocs or because I haven't looked after myself during the week. So it's to have that appreciation is awesome. And I do remember what he's talking about as well because even I'd get to like a Thursday night and think, "Oh Christ, I'm not feeling."
My legs hanging off.
I just loved it. Yeah, that's what it boils down to. It was the favorite. It was my favorite thing to do. Is get out there and play with those boys. And so I just would try and do everything I could to make sure I could do that for as many times as I could and for as long as possible. Really.
Let's talk about life after rugby. Because you mentioned it a few times there, Saracens have been amazingly supportive of you and clearly have seen the person you are and desperately wanted to integrate that into their corporate side, which is unbelievable. You're director of the Saracens Way.
Yes.
Firstly, what is the Saracens Way?
So at the moment, that's a very good question. It won't. So Saracens Way is essentially... It's a program where we take the story and the journey of how we went from being a chronically underachieving club to being, you know, 5-time Premiership and triple European champions. And actually how everything that's created that success is hugely transferable into other organisations, whether that's public sector, insurance, city, public, whatever it might be, which is all, it's all based around people. You know, we had this kind of belief at the club that if we create good people, we create good rugby players. If you kind of take all that, and you obviously got to break down the detail and the minutiae of the day-to-day how it works, but if you take that aspect of it, it actually doesn't matter what your job is. It doesn't matter what you do. We can help you be better at it by focusing on the relationships between your team, by the cohesion, by having shared values, by having a common vision, and all this kind of stuff.
Very interesting.
So we do all that. And it was, you know, it was, for the first 2 years, it was brilliant, you know, in terms of being given, at the A-level business studies, I chucked the ball around for 10 years, and all of a sudden I was given a business to run, and I didn't have a fucking clue what I was doing. But it was actually perfect for me in terms of, you know, still being challenged. Yes. Still learning. In terms of it being similar to what to playing rugby, I was still being challenged every day. I was learning every day, and having to learn pretty quick. And I was making, I was making a hatful of errors, but thankfully I learned from most of them, hopefully. And it was as a business, it was going really, really well. And then obviously January 2020 happened. And you know, we're having to kind of rethink a lot of things.
How hard was it mentally transitioning into an office environment for you?
I'll be honest with you, I don't think I have. In the sense with my job, I'm out and about all the time. You know, I'm in town most days with clients or in meetings. If I'm not in town, I'll then go into the office, but it might only be for a morning or an afternoon. So I was probably only in the office a couple of times a week, max. Because in terms of Saracen's Way, in terms of, I was the only one in the business. So I was doing everything, you know, selling it, delivering it, marketing it, and all this kind of stuff. So I was out and about. So I never really had to make that full jump, which again, for me, was probably ideal, because I don't think I would have enjoyed it, to be completely honest with you. So to be busy and to be out and about, to be meeting people, to be meeting new people and all that kind of stuff kind of suits me as a, you know, my personality quite well. I think the transition I have made, which was an interesting one, was more just learning about people in business, and people are very different to what I was used to in terms of business is a very different beast to playing rugby. Particularly when you're dealing with people from different businesses. And there's only a minority, but you do meet the odd person and you kind of sit back and go, wow, okay. Yes. Didn't realise people operated in this way. Because you're so used to being, you know, living and breathing with very like-minded people. So that was an interesting one. But yeah, like with everything, you get a read on people quite quickly, and then you just make your own decisions from that.
I can imagine there's two things, and actually, well, this is what I'm wondering. There's two things that might have affected the Saracen's Way. Really, one is obviously coronavirus, which presumably has put the Saracen's Way on hold for the time being whilst this all settles down. But there's also the salary cap saga. Yeah. What effect did that have on the business, if any?
Huge. To be honest, the business disappeared.
Really?
To be completely honest with you, yeah. I mean, in terms of, the business is still there, but in terms of actually creating business and revenue overnight, gone.
Wow.
Which was really, again, when I look, looking back at it now, it was only, 6 months ago. You know, in terms of, again, for my own personal development, having to deal with that and front that and try and formulate a plan has actually been amazing in terms of the opportunity and what I've learned from it. But yeah, at the time it was difficult, mate, because as I say, the business was flying. You know, we were going to on track to have a brilliant year, had some really big kind of contracts and bits coming up. And then that news came, and within half an hour, I had my first client pull out. Phone call, really sorry, but we can't do that. And it wasn't anything to do with the course or me, I hope, but it was association.
Of course.
It was, you know, I had people that had put groups of employees through the program before, I'm going to do some more, who had brilliant results from it, who wanted to do it for the content, but they couldn't be seen as a business to be associated with us at that period of time. And that was difficult to take because I'm sat there going, well, you like me, you know, it's a good program, but I get it. I completely get it. You know,
and it's a monstrous shame because actually salary cap saga aside, really the salary cap had absolutely no effect on the cultures and the values you built as players, which is the core of the business.
I mean, I don't want to get into it too much because this isn't what this pod is about. And we,
no, of course,
afraid. But yeah, listen, the thing that was tough is that as an ex-player and talking to a lot of other ex-players, you know, when it was all happening, we know why we've been where we've been in terms of the success. We know why we're all as close as we are. And it had nothing to do with salary cap, absolutely nothing. And we know how hard we worked to create the environment that we did. What's sad is that, unfortunately, there's no fact of black and white. Yeah, there's no denying we breached the cap.
No.
Yeah, because we did.
Yeah.
And so we have, again, we have to accept that. I think we have now. We've got to try and move on and move forward from it. And I think that's what's sad is that everything we've done now is kind of has a question mark over it because of this. And a lot of what we created has been undermined to a point because of this. But if you flip that coin, what you've got now is an opportunity we would never have had before.
No.
To take that step back and actually really evaluate who we are and who we want to be. And if we can do that, then I have no doubt in my mind that we'll get right back to where we were. But we've got to do that. And there's, again, lots of detail and minutiae into how we go about, you know, the conversations and the things we've got to do. But I think it's a rare opportunity that any successful organisation gets to have something catastrophic happen to it on every level, from the rugby, from the business, personally. There's a lot of people, training ground side and office side, that have been part of this club for a long, long time. And so it hits you personally when something like this happens. So to have that, but then to have all, it's almost kind of, you don't start again because we've done too much to start again. But you kind of have this now new level playing field or this new springboard of which to create this new chapter in our story. And how we do that is obviously the next step of it. But I think it was awful. And obviously you're very close with Joe, and it was, you know, for their family, the Ray family in particular, it was must have been horrendous. But I do generally think with anything in life, anything that bad happens, there's always something, an opportunity that can come from it, and something good, however big or small it might be. But I do genuinely believe that there's a huge opportunity for us to grow from this. Mm. And to make sure, firstly, that it doesn't happen again, because if it happens again, then it's a whole different kettle of fish. But I just think we can grow from it and learn from it. I do think in the long run, we can be better for it.
Mm. It's kind of segued wonderfully into my next question, actually, which is all centered around positivity. Mm. Because what happened to Henry was obviously a truly horrific thing. Mm. And your will and your run of injuries were horrendous too, ending your career. But both you and Henry have such a positive mentality. Mm. What are the key things you've learned and that have helped you keep that positivity? It's almost like the core of your beings.
I don't know. I just think, again, I think I am how I am because of other people and because of things that I've been through. I think it's kind of a big part of it is not knowing what positivity is, but kind of having context around it. So you see people that are positive and they're just really high-fivey, energetic, clappy. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're kind of positive in their outlook and mindset. I think it's different. You can be a positive person and be very happy in this, that, and the other. But that's different to having an actual positive outlook and trying to figure out the best in any given scenario. I think they're two different things. And I think for me, as I said earlier, going through what I've been through and then watching Henry go through what he'd been through and then watching how he dealt with it, watching how my family's dealt with it, being around very positive people at the club, you know, there's no denying the lads that I played with were all phenomenally positive people. You know, the club was a positive place to be in. And I just think I've been surrounded by these brilliant people, which, and it's naturally kind of rubbed off on me. And I think with Henry's situation, there's no denying the huge subconscious. And I would never tell him this, and I still to this day have never told him to his face. He just hears it via pods like this, just because as an older brother, you know, I don't want his ego to get too big. But I just think, you know, that situation undoubtedly has had a monumental impact on anyone that knows it subconsciously. And this perspective piece, again, it's the perspective piece. You know, yes, something terrible can happen, but actually, okay, well, what can we do to get out of it? What can we, what slither of hope can we gain from it? And, you know, it's like anything. We moved house just before lockdown. And, you know, it's fairly old. And this is a ridiculous analogy, but it's fairly old house and you want to do stuff and all of a sudden there's 10 other things get uncovered you need to fix.
Yes.
You kind of, okay, well, actually what this means is that we fix all the problems. So going forward, touch wood, we're not going to have any issues again and it's done. And yeah, so I just think that's actually ridiculous. That's a ridiculous analogy. You can cut that. You can cut that one out. That's, but I just think without waffling, which I have, I think I've been super lucky to have had the experiences that I've had, to be surrounded by the people I've been surrounded by. And I think that in turn has given me the outlook I have. It's never been a conscious thing. It's never been something where I've sat back and thought, I need to be more positive. I need to be more like Henry. I need to be more like Owen or whoever it is. It's just been a very subconscious thing of learning from other people, learning from experiences, and equally trying to help other people. Like I get too positive sometimes, where I think we spoke about it before this call, where if someone comes to me with an issue, my first instinct is to try and fix it, but from a really good place, but try and be like, okay, well, let's have a look at this, have a look at that, when actually all that person needs is just me to shut up and them to talk and me to listen.
No, I exactly the same problem with my girlfriend, actually. Yeah, all she wanted me to listen, but I'm very solutions focused too.
I think I've learned a lot. I've been very fortunate in my life to have just some amazing people around me.
You were about to say before I cut off, and you were about to say equally. What were you about to say there?
I don't know. I was waffling. I'm not sure, to be honest.
No problem. Talking about your issues presumably has been at the forefront, I mean, of your mentality shift and being able to actually release some of that pent up emotional energy from the setbacks you've had. You're very tight knit with your family, very close. And that's, whenever I've met you guys, it's very obvious to see. But how important has talking been in your ability to cope with setbacks?
Again, more so in later life. Again, when I was younger, probably one of the other issues around how I dealt with things was that I did it all on my own. And I'm still on more often than not, and on the whole, I still like to deal with things on my own. I think it's partly where I'm wired, but you know, my wife in particular is very good at getting me to talk about stuff. Because I need to, and I think I remember when we first got together, I wouldn't talk about anything, you know, feelings or that kind of stuff, because I kind of never had to, but she's been very good at that, and I think that's helped me a lot, particularly with retiring from rugby. In particular, she was brilliant in that whole scenario, just kind of one, encouraging me to talk, but then just sitting back and letting me go, as in just letting me talk and just get it all out and get it all off, and then we move on. So I think talking is massive, and it's obviously around, you know, we look at the bigger mental health picture, especially with men, and it gets said all the time, but I think, you know, for one reason or another, I don't know why, men inherently don't talk about stuff that they should be talking about. And I think
why do you think that is?
I don't know. I really don't know. I think part of it's probably like, probably maybe a sense of not wanting to be vulnerable, I think, is probably a big part of it.
Interesting.
And I think it's maybe a fear fear that you're going to get judged for what you're going to say. I think it's probably, but that's, I mean, that's for people across any walk of life. But for whatever reason, I think when it comes to mental health, maybe men in particular, it's more prevalent. But I think the thing is, you know, and I've actually had it with a lot of, on a very different level, more kind of business stuff, but with a lot of clients where someone will have an issue and they don't tell anyone that they've got this issue. And because of that, they think that they're the only person that thinks that way. And the second they say it, about five other people go, I'm so pleased you said that because I've been thinking the exact same thing for ages. And if you take that and extrapolate it into kind of mental health stuff, I think it's the same, you get the same scenarios where someone will be dealing with a certain issue or something's happened that they're trying to cope with. And they won't deal with it because they think they're the only one that's had to deal with it. And so maybe no one else will understand it or no one else will get it, and therefore it won't help. And then the second they do say something, all of a sudden someone will go, well, you know what? I actually went through something very similar a few years ago, or I'm going through the exact same thing, whatever it is. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, wow, okay, I actually have people I can talk to that understand what I'm dealing with and understand what I'm going through. And I think it's that initial leap to actually say something, I think it's quite, and which is why things like this are so good, because, you know, in hearing other people deal with stuff, hopefully it encourages people to kind of talk about how they're feeling.
Have you seen rugby transition? Because obviously you've lived and breathed it for 15 years now, both through Saracens, on the pitch, and in corporate life. How has rugby's mentality or mental health shifted from your perspective?
Yeah, I think it's shifted quite a bit. I go to my own personal journey with it. And again, we said in the call before, when I was playing, early on when I was playing, I was extremely ignorant to mental health. When I look back now, I was beyond ignorant to it. Like, I just didn't get it at all. I couldn't understand why people would suffer from depression when they finished playing rugby. I didn't understand why people would have mental health problems around what are seemingly quite small issues. Put my hand up, just didn't get it at all. I was quite brutal in my thinking about it and outlook on it. And it wasn't until I got towards the end of my playing career and then actually finished playing that I completely U-turned. And I was very fortunate, touch wood, that I didn't suffer from kind of any real mental health issues, but I all of a sudden had a huge appreciation for how people could and why someone would suffer from mental health and the impact it would have. Because from the sports point of view, you know, you finish, especially when your career's kind of finished early for one reason or another, and everything you were just disappears. Your identity, your salary, your fitness levels, things, you know, things that seemingly aren't that big, but actually, you know, when they just go, you're like this, initially anyway, you feel like this different person. And all of a sudden, I completely U-turned, I got it. And I was, you know, and it's like this kind of awakening to it all. And actually, I've gone so far where I think more stuff needs to be done still. Particularly when players finish, I think there's a lot more we can do. But going back to in terms of how rugby's changed, yeah, massively, hugely. Just in terms of the fact that you get ex-rugby players coming on these sorts of things and talking in itself is a huge shift, because that wouldn't happen probably 10, 15 years ago. The acute awareness of a player's wellness now when they're playing, you know, on the field and off the field and in their home lives, the care that's given to players. I mean, I can only talk for Saracens, but the care that's given to players' families, you know, a huge part of a player's mental a player's mental health and well-being is at home. A player can be struggling with mental health because of something that's happening at home, not because of the rugby. But what rugby used to do was not give a flying what's it about your home life. You know, you're here to play rugby, you're going to deal with that. So even the fact that there's care and awareness now about players' families, their kids, their wives, again, speaks to actually rugby shifting away from this kind of, you know, let's not talk, let's crack on, to actually wanting to care for people. So I think rugby has changed. I mean, I think it can still go further, and there will be people out there that have suffered from mental health after a time from rugby who can put a lot more detail into how and where and why it can go further than I can. But yeah, I do think he can do more. Everywhere we can do more for it, you know. And as I say, these things are good because it's kind of the start of that.
What's next for Will Fraser then?
Well, I need to mow the garden tomorrow. it's just, you know, I think it's, you can't look too far ahead when everything is going on in the world at the moment. I think it's kind of day at a time. Let's get through this pandemic. Let's we'll get back to work. And then we can kind of figure out what the next steps are. But for me, just, you know, I've moved house, got a lovely wife, want to kind of carry on that whole family planning, the rest of it, and kind
very nice.
Of my life for myself.
Very nice.
Wherever and however I might do that.
Very good. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. What an unbelievable story, but also, I mean, I love doing this sort of things with people like yourself who are inherently supremely positive about life, and what you've gone through is unbelievable. So thank you so much for sharing it, and if you ever want a game for Old Mill Hillians, I'm sure Joe will tap you up. He's actually a very good back rower, so I'm not sure
Sam Lahan and Joe have told me that in the past. I've been offered a game before and I've said I've lost that much weight, I'm that weak, I can't run. People would never know that I used to make a living out of playing rugby, so I'm not going to, I won't put myself through the shame.
Don't worry, it's only old Pisporians, so it doesn't matter. Will, thanks, mate.
Good man. Cheers, dude.
Cheers.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening and supporting the podcast. Please subscribe if you haven't already, and find us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn through @TheRutPod for more updates on who's coming up next on the show. Special thanks to my team, Ricky Batchu and Phil Bateman, who helped me produce The Rut. Next time on The Rut, I sit down with young entrepreneur Kay Van Farrier, the founder of Ask Winston, to discuss the impact his best friend's suicide had on his mental health in a very emotional episode. See you then.